Welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox and Andrew Hansen, and we are in the studio in Bedford, which I love being here and I love our town, but this is kind of a letdown.
A little bit.
Yeah. Being at the PGA last Friday was way better. No offense to anybody here, but this kind of bites. On the bright side, though, we do have a guest that we haven't talked to in a little bit, Corey Parker, the athletic director at Bedford High School. Corey, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
Of course. I can't believe summer's just about over, but when I walked into school earlier this week, the place was buzzing. You had a gym with a football practice going on. Fall sports are most certainly in full swing. What are you seeing on your end going into year two as far as the craziness leading up to the school year?
Yeah, it amazes me. And now going into my 14th year, they're really the summer workouts and the interactions in high schools, whether it's driver's ed or competency recovery or workouts of any kind, it's just more and more cars are in the parking lot each and every day, which is good, which keeps people active, keeps people doing things. Certainly, it's been a busy summer for us with all our fall sports, doing some sort of workouts, activities, team runs, you name it. They try to do it in the summertime, and I think that's what, you know, quality programs that strive to make it to the final day each season and championship games, that's what you got to do. You got to do a lot in the summer, and although a lot of people still get family time and vacations, the idea of, you know, putting the cleats away for 9 months after the season just isn't the way kids are raised these days, and it's healthy because I think being active and strength training and familiarizing yourself with your teammates prior to the August 13th start date really puts teams in a competitive advantage, and it's no different here than most places. And so with that said, it's been a very busy summer for kids, and seeing them working out is always a plus when I'm in the office, no question.
That's awesome. So there, as always, there are a lot of storylines heading into the fall sports season. Any of the bigger storylines or names that our listeners can expect to hear more of going into the fall?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, statewide recognition. We returned some student-athletes this year that garnered some impressive accolades at the end of last year. C.J. Ledoux, the overall individual golf state champion for all divisions. You know, he returns as a junior on the golf team and a team that hopes to defend their state championship and go for a fifth straight title. Brianna Coco, who was a senior on the girls' soccer team. She was the Gatorade Player of the Year last year. Her and Grant Levine, also from baseball, respectively, won those awards. So we're excited to see her return. But, you know, I think overall, individual achievements really is not the striving goal for us, and individual achievements come with collective efforts from everybody, and certainly all our coaches are striving for, you know, each kid to strive to be the best they can be in whatever role they have so that ultimately it results in wins and long, successful seasons.
Now, you mentioned a couple sports in golf and soccer that I'm thinking back a year ago. It doesn't feel like it was a year ago that we were talking about the golf team winning a state championship or soccer with that double overtime heartbreaker, but I guess it was, man. Time flies when you're having fun.
Time's quick. There's no question. Yeah, it's amazing how fast it goes, whether it's a season, a year, the summer. It's a quick process, to say the least. And so, but I know the fall coaches are excited to get back on the field and get training, and kids are getting back into the full swing of things. And you know, I think partly they're eager to get back to school, too, and get back into the usual day-to-day routine. So we're there.
Well, Corey, as you head into your second full year in Bedford, I'm guessing you had at least a few minutes or maybe a day or two this summer to sit back and reflect a little bit on year one. What are some of the things that really worked well for you that you're going to keep going with? And what are some things maybe that you're going to try new this year or try a little bit differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a great first year. Selfishly for me, it was phenomenal. I mean, I truly mean it when I say I'm lucky to be here. I think it's the best school district in the state, and to oversee the athletic program that strives to be the best is a luxury for me to come in each and every day. And so I look at it as an awesome opportunity, and every day enjoyed it. You know, obviously getting to know the district better, getting to know the faculty, getting to know a lot of our youth sports and the recreational piece and how we can facilitate and help with that certainly working with Lurgio and the athletics there, I think is an ongoing process, and every day it's getting a little better. And you know, meeting with the town and Park and Rec, and how we can help facilitate some of the fields that we share with them, and how we can bolster those environments for the kids, whether it's third grade soccer or JV soccer or varsity sports on a certain rectangular field here in town. It's just continually strengthening those relationships. And like anything else, it takes time. It takes interaction with people. And so I think that's an ongoing process. But I think for the first year, I think it went really well. Getting to know the building, getting to know the culture here is great. Getting to know the student athletes, which is the most enjoyable part of my job, is one that I think went really well. We're hoping to strive on and continually strengthen that and try to be continually working on the core of what it means to be a Bulldog student athlete, and you know, stretching that from all athletes, from all sports. And so that's an ongoing process that we're going to continually strive to get better this year and work on that communication aspect of it. But I think all in all, going into year two, it's like anything else, it's full transparency, working with our students, working with our coaches, and communicating with parents when necessary as far as how we can make this the best experience possible for them. And sometimes when there's not the experience of opportunities, how can we create those opportunities here and build the numbers and what kids are doing after schools and representing Bedford. So that's certainly something we're always working on and working to strive to continually make better.
Well said. That's great to hear.
Yeah, I was going to say that's an impressive answer, and it's fun. You and I have talked about some of the lower level sports as they were, like kids sports, and things that need to be done, changes that need to be made. It's good to see that that's something that you're focused on, because ultimately to grow a program, you need that, the feeder programs that go into it. Kids just don't show up at the high school ready to be star varsity athletes. There need to be feeder systems that get them there. And it's good to hear that you're focused on that. We're joined by Corey Parker, the athletic director of Bedford High. And speaking of feeder programs, a kid that I saw back in the Little League days, and we saw him play through the high school, Grant Levine has been on our minds this summer. He's leading the Pioneer League in hitting 361, second in OPS. He's tearing it up a little bit. How closely have you followed him this summer, and does what he's done so far surprise you?
Yeah, I've followed it pretty closely. You know, the Twitter handle for the Grand Junction team that he's playing now, I think, has picked up a lot of followers in 03110.
I've been saying it the whole time. They need to be selling merchandise. I would be their East Coast sales rep.
You know, I'll be honest. I went on their site, and I joked with Kevin a few times about, you know, I expect some gear when this, you know, when he makes it out there, and their website is terrible. There's only a hat
that
you can purchase, surprisingly.
We talked about this. Kevin was my mule. He brought me back a T-shirt.
Nice. Well, good to see someone that can represent.
Yeah.
But at the same time, no, it's been great. It's, you know, what Grant's doing out there is not a surprise to anyone. Certainly, you know, the success rate is somewhat surprising, just because he's 18 and he's thriving and he's leading the league and was an all-star. And I guess the rate of how fast he's projected to that level is exciting to see. But as far as character and work ethic, it's not surprising at all. You know, getting to know him last year, being familiar with him, just living in Bedford and seeing what he had done through Little League and all the way through, and then how humble he is and appreciative he is, and, you know, conducts himself in a way that is just phenomenal. It's not surprising, and I'm happy for him. And he's reaping the benefits of hard work and dedication and focus that he's had for, you know, probably a decade or longer in baseball. And so for him to, we talked about it at our spring awards night. I mean, he does the little things. He was chasing foul balls. He was picking up teammates after, you know, they came out or struck out in a game. And I think a lot of scouts really kind of grabbed, you know, saw that this spring. They knew his baseball accolades, but when you see the star of the team and the state doing those little jobs. I shouldn't say little, but doing everything that's expected of a teammate is phenomenal. And, you know, I couldn't be more proud for him and happy for our school district, because, like I said, he's pretty much the first Bedford athlete that has, you know, made it to this level and statewide, really. I think from a positional player trying to make it to the big leagues, he's one of the, I think he'd be the first New Hampshire-born player. I know Sam Fold obviously had a stint in a successful career, but I don't believe he was born in New Hampshire. So really exciting stuff. Wish him the best, and wouldn't surprise me at all if he jumps to Double-A next year and hopefully continually thrives up through the ranks.
It will be interesting to see what they do. And, of course, yeah, with Grant, we were doing one of the games in the spring, and my daughter happened to be there, and they needed somebody to go out with a rake and rake a spot, and who grabs the rake and goes out there? And it's Grant. And I said, hey, check out, the star is out there with the rake. It's not only is it good for the scouts to see that, but it's also good for kids to see that.
Sure.
And it's amazing. I joke now, I remember 3 or 4 years ago, I was coaching a team. We had one particular kid, and I'm sure you know him and you know his brothers. Sean Green was the one who would always come up to us after practice, look you in the eye and say, thanks, coach. Now it takes you 5 minutes when practice is done because every kid thanks you and speaks to you after practice. All it takes is one, and then suddenly it's a cultural thing. It becomes really a contagious thing.
Agreed. Like I said, it's the special things that, you know, create again that culture and the respect level that everyone sees, and, you know, wins and losses come and go, and sometimes they're in your favor and sometimes they're not. But little things like that you would expect to be the norm just unfortunately aren't everywhere.
Right.
And when we set that tone, it's much easier to carry forth that and build that expectation so that one team, one student athlete, one student is not going to deter from that expectation of what it means to be a Bulldog. And certainly when all eyes are on an individual and they're acting that way, it's much easier, I think, for everyone to fall in line. And like I said, wish him the best. And he's just a great product of being a student athlete from Bedford High School.
It's been a lot of fun so far. So thinking about some other fun stuff, you and I talked earlier this week briefly about the PGA. And I know you're a big golf fan. Who would be your captain's picks if Corey Parker was the Ryder Cup captain?
So I'm cheating a little bit to pull up the rankings.
I'd expect you would.
The top eight. I certainly, obviously, what Tiger's been able to do in the last couple of majors and kind of bring his game back, certainly exciting. I think that's a no-brainer that Tiger would be there with the intimidation factor. I think he still presents in a match play format. And then probably most likely Matt Kuchar. I've always been a fan of him and his style. And again, he's one that comes to mind that I think has a pretty strong Ryder Cup record and in representing. I think it'd be hard to not choose Phil Mickelson based off what Furyk's going to do. But I'd probably go Kuchar, to be honest with you. Phil is, you know, another player, surprising and exciting to watch, but that full button-down shirt that he wore to one of those tournaments not too long ago was just that, and he needs a haircut. But nonetheless,
my wife wouldn't let me out of the house.
The Ryder Cup to me, and I don't watch a lot of golf, the Ryder Cup is one of the more enjoyable sporting events to watch. Just anytime they're representing our country in a match play format like that would probably, you know, 15 to 20 of the top 30 golfers in the world. It's exciting to watch, and you see that passion from the players. And the Reed McIlroy match a couple of years ago comes to mind when it was just putts after putts, and you know, a ruckus environment for golf, which was exciting to watch. So definitely, we'll Ryder Cup DVR that and play catch up on the weekend. There's no question of that.
I was gonna say Hansen made a face when you said Matt Kuchar. Do you have thoughts there, golf guy?
He's a great American team player with a strong Ryder Cup record. I was just thinking of your selections in the PGA for fantasy that included.
Oh, I got crushed.
You included Matt Kuchar.
I did.
So I know you're a fan as well.
I'm a fan, but I think he's a guy to me, and Corey and I talked about it a little bit, hasn't won a major. He's a guy, he's always hanging out. He's always, or always seems to be, in contention. Doesn't win, but he's the guy who plays four steady rounds, and you look and you're like, it's, I guess it feels like the person on Survivor where you go, there's the really pretty one, and I don't like her, and there's him, and he's really strong. And who's that third guy? Like, yeah. He's the reality show contestant who somehow manages to get through until the end. That's how I feel about him.
He's always finishing, he's like, between 5 and 20.
Yeah, he's just there.
And he's the guy on the Ryder Cup team who's not going to hurt you.
No.
You know he's going to be a solid, steady teammate when they play in pairs.
It's weird, though. You think, and Corey's sitting here while we're talking golf, you think about what he was like when he was coming out of Georgia Tech. Like, he was the thing. And instead, he's turned in a really steady career on the PGA Tour. I would love to look what his career winnings are. But, all right, enough of that. Let's move on to something more important in New England here. The Sox won 8 of their last 10. Potentially a historic season. They're playing above 700 ball. Is this another championship season? Corey Parker, you tell us.
I have no idea. I mean, it's exciting that they're winning the games. And, you know, I think my parents' generation grew up with the Red Sox on in the background. And so every night I'll pop into my parents and it's on one of the TVs. They're probably sleeping on the couch, but it's on. And it's exciting. Obviously, you know, new management this year, somewhat new direction, I think, perhaps. And, you know, whatever they're doing is working. And so it's exciting to see they're winning well, winning, and obviously they're winning at a crazy good clip right now. Like many years, when you get in the playoffs and it's a best of series, it's all bets are off, and what you do in April and May and June and July really doesn't matter. So I think at this point they've probably almost clinched a playoff spot, and hopefully they can just build that momentum. And you know, any New England team that's winning and is advancing in the playoffs is exciting as a sports fan. Certainly, I wish it well. And from Celtics, obviously the Patriots hopefully will be strong again this year. So it should be fun to see, fun to cheer on, and hopefully the first pitch is before 9:15, and we can actually watch one of these games.
Wouldn't that be nice? PGA Tour career earnings. Number one, you know, it's
Tiger.
It's Tiger.
Yeah.
Number two.
Phil?
Yeah, logical. Where do you think Matt Kuchar ranks? I'll ask Hanson first, and then Corey will be second.
I'll say he's seventh.
No. Corey, what do you think? All-time money leaders in the PGA. You can't Google that.
No
I
typing.
Hear the keyboard in
no
the background.
No typing allowed.
Matt Kuchar, with career earnings of almost $44 million, is 13th in PGA Tour history.
He timed it right.
Yes, he absolutely timed it right. So, Corey Parker, are you there?
I am.
Did you fall off? I thought you fell out of your chair when you heard that Matt Kuchar had made almost $44 million on the PGA Tour.
You know, you blended out there. I didn't even catch that part. He made $44
million, huh? $44 million.
Good for him.
It's insane. Like, yeah, some of these
good
numbers,
for him.
It's Monopoly money. So, yeah, Tiger's at $113 million. Phil is in second at almost $88 million. Number three will surprise you. Click here for more. Who do you think number three is? You're never going to get it.
Ernie Els.
No.
A current Ernie Els. Is
he's
it easy?
Current-ish.
Yeah, I don't know if he's current, Lauren. That's a stretch.
Ernie.
Good for those guys.
Easy E is six.
A lot of money.
Who's number three?
Oh, I thought you said it was Ernie Els.
No, Ernie Els is sixth.
Oh, it's a current player at three?
I don't know if he's current.
So this is all-time winnings?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's biased. You're not going to have Arnold Palmer on here, obviously, but...
Sure.
He is currently playing. He played in the PGA. However, he's 55.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say Vijay Singh.
Boom.
Nicely done.
Got it. All right.
Yeah. On that note, he was a dominating player for a while.
Yeah, he really was. That's impressive.
Yep.
All right. We're going to let you go. Corey Parker, high school athletic, or the athletic director of Bedford High School. It'd be nice if I could speak. Thank you for your time, as always, and look forward to catching up very soon.
Yeah, Andrew, Lauren, thank you guys. Appreciate it. Hope to see you guys soon at a game here around the corner.
There's
wish everyone the best last couple weeks of summer, and I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Same here. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Thank you. That was Corey Parker, the athletic director of Bedford High School. We'll take a quick break and come right back. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. back here in the studios on Meeting House Road. Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, coming to you on Bedford at 105.1. So a week ago, as we indicated, you and I were hanging out in the media center at the PGA Championship, attempting to get interviews with Michael Collins from ESPN, the ESPN caddy who is, I would say, the most recognizable human being covering golf at this point.
He's right up there.
Hands down. Like, you can't miss him. He's short and squatty and has a multicolored large beard. And very nice guy. I wish that we had had more time in the media center and didn't have some deadlines, but I think we probably could have nabbed him for an interview. And then Rick Riley, formerly of Sports Illustrated, now of The Athletic, and we had a chance to talk to talk to Rick. And my favorite part was that he thought he knew me, and I think he figured out that he didn't. But we thought we had Rick Riley on the hook, and he wriggled away. So as it happens.
Yeah, Michael Collins has a real entertaining spirit. He's fun to watch.
He's fun to watch. He wears good shirts. Like he gets what his role is as far as golf goes, and he's disarming.
Yes.
So everybody talks to him, and everybody talks to him. It's a gift that guy has. Everybody talks to him like they've known him for years.
You can't dislike him.
No, it's amazing. And so you look at a guy like that and how he covers a sport. It's just that's. I don't know that that's a trick of journalism. It's just a trick of being human. You're very good at being human. Would you come cover golf for us, please?
He's figured it out.
Yeah. So, but you and I were out there. I literally walked into Bellerive. I don't know why I didn't think through this a little bit better. If I had thought through it, I would have actually seen maybe a couple strokes of golf. I should have taken a shuttle or the Uber to the media parking lot and then just taken a quick shuttle over. Instead, what I did was took the shuttle with everybody, which turned out I was in a bus with, I'm going to say, 90% dudes who were all in the same boat that I was, or the same bus, literally. They got off the shuttle and play was suspended. Then walked into the setup at Bellerive thinking that I was okay. I'm good to go. This is awesome. I'm going to find the media center. Really?
And you knew what that meant.
And I knew what it meant, but I was so hoping against hope that I was wrong.
Or that it would be a half hour delay like many thought it might be.
I was going to say, we talked to a friend of my sister's, oddly enough, the PGA, who said, oh, yeah, it'll probably be half an hour. It's going to blow right through. And said it was like we were getting slammed. But I walk into Bellerive through and the media center wasn't terribly easy to get to. Ozzie Smith was the designated host of the week by the PGA. I'm not sure how that happened. Ozzie is really big into golf, the former St. Louis Cardinal shortstop, Hall of Famer. And I have no idea how many people go to a tournament like that.
Well, I think it was potentially record crowds. I haven't seen the numbers, but that place was a mob scene.
That was wall-to-wall humans, not to mention compound. They sold it out, but compounded by the fact that Tiger was there and playing well. But of all the random people to run into when I'm walking in, I run into Ozzie Smith.
Perfect.
Like, so, I mean, you get the positive and the negative. Like, I got the negative. I didn't actually get to see golf, but I went, holy cow, there's Ozzie. And there's something fun about seeing former professional athletes. You can tell former athletes tend to just, for some reason, and maybe it's the same thing that made them a great athlete to start, but dudes just remain in good shape. Like, Ozzie looked like if the Cardinals said, we need a shortstop, come out and play today, he wouldn't have been doing backflips on the field, but Ozzie could have gone out there and played just fine.
Oh, of course.
I mean, like, not an ounce of fat on the guy. He's shorter than I would have thought. I think he's like 5'8".
With hands like that and those skills defensively that he had perfected over the course of 20-plus years, he could go three nights in a row without sleep, show up at short, and probably make every play the next night.
Oh, guaranteed. He's listed at 5'11", 150, by the way, but So yeah, Ozzie was there, which was really a lot of fun to see. I think about when I ran into Hank Aaron years ago at the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee. He was in his mid-70s at that point, and he looked like he could still play. Like, he I don't know. But, I mean, you look at some of the old Red Sox guys, too. You know, Johnny Pesky seemed like, for years, he was one that just stayed in shape and just looked like an athlete. And I have no way to describe it other than some people age differently than the rest of us. And I don't know. So anyway, that was a tangent to a tangent. So,
well, that brings us to the guy who has gotten back into shape.
Thank goodness. You know, yeah. With a fused back.
Eldrick.
I love him.
And I had the pleasure of staying through the weekend and watching the action on Sunday at Bellerive. And the thing that jumped out at me the most was the difference in energy surrounding Tiger versus surrounding Koepka, who went on to win.
Mm-hmm.
And you could feel it, you could sense it, you could hear it throughout the golf course in a lot of different ways. And where I was for most of the day was camped out on the 11th hole, which is the par four that's drivable. It was playing at 294 yards that day. So it was a really exciting place to be to watch guys decide whether to try and drive the green and make an eagle or play it safe, lay up, and try and wedge in and get an easy putt at birdie. But, you know, the way that it kind of came across to me can be summed up as follows. Tiger birdied 9. The fans' announcement brings chills on 11th hole. Tiger crouches down, his birdie try above ground on 11th hole. Koepka walks fairway, leading in gallery's wake on 11th hole. Red shirt haymaker buries Sunday 64, fires up 18 mob. Golf claps at Bellerive serenade Koepka's tap-in, the PGA champ.
Well, the other thing that was weird about Koepka was he just hit his tap-in before Adam Scott had holed out.
Right.
And I don't know if I talked about it with you or if I talked about it with somebody else, but that was a moment. And it could have been a moment, and it should have been a moment, but I don't know. I don't know if he lacks the media savvy or just the general PR savvy, but Adam Scott knew it. So things like that to me are just bizarre. The other thing about Brooks Koepka is he's like the Ed Hockley of the PGA Tour. The
strong fella.
He's got some guns, and he likes to show them off. Like, his golf shirt might be a little bit small, and Tommy, which way is the gym? The gym's that way. But you look at him, okay, put him in a lineup without showing his arms and ask a casual golf fan to identify Brooks Koepka, most people are going to fail miserably.
Yeah, up until this weekend.
I don't even think they would. I don't know. He's a good golfer. And he's a great golfer. He'll be a Hall of Fame golfer because he's won 3 majors. But just there's a lot that just blends him in with the rest of the crowd. For some reason, there's some guys that just elevate out of that crowd. Phil Mickelson, yeah, he's left-handed, but Phil got out of that crowd. Bubba Watson got out of that crowd. Like, some of the guys just, and I just cited 2 left-handed golfers, but some of the guys just elevate themselves out of that crowd, whether it's through charisma, whether it's through being clever. And some of the guys are just always kind of in that pond with everybody else.
Yeah, Koepka is more in the category of he just wants to have his play do the talking. And as he piles up the majors, he's going to stand out that way. But I actually heard an interesting quote about what you're talking about, that moment at 18 when everybody knew he was going to win the tournament. And if he wanted to, he could have marked his ball and, you know, had that moment all to himself with the last shot of the tournament, like most major championship winners do. Given that opportunity, I heard his quote, which explained it. It was kind of interesting. The reason he said he didn't mark his ball and wait is because his ball would have been about a foot behind the hole, right in Adam Scott's line of vision. And he knew that Adam Scott was putting for second place, which was ended up being a $400,000 difference. Actually, $200,000. Basically, solo second was $1.2 million. Solo third was $800,000. So if he had tied for second, made the putt and tied for second, he would have split second place with Tiger and made a million. He missed the putt, so he only made $800,000. So it was a $200,000 miss. He knew a lot was on the line for Adam Scott. He didn't want his marker to be in his line of vision. So really interesting explanation on that one. But to get back to the difference in the energy between the two of them, when I was standing there on the 11th with Tiger, you know, Tiger hits his tee shot, and then first of all, right away, all of the fans start running, almost running up the sidewalk as Gary Woodland's coming to the tee, about to hit, and everybody is running down the side of the
fairway. Because they want to see him in a second shot.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So quite a challenge for Gary Woodland to try and compete under those circumstances. But the other thing was, after Tiger played the hole, most of the fans left, and Koepka was two groups behind. By the time he and Adam Scott got there, Koepka's leading the tournament. I think Adam was either tied for first or in second at that place, at that juncture. But as they're coming up the fairway, it was just a smattering of golf claps for the guy who's leading the tournament, and barely anybody is there watching him still. They've all moved ahead to try and follow Tiger. It was really almost an eerie quiet in the air with Koepka coming through.
There's just something like, it's hard to explain what it felt like in the 90s and 2000s when Tiger was at the top of his game, and it was like everything stopped. And we were watching him play. And so it's funny. Toy makers will release a toy when they think that the kids that played with the toy, they'll re-release it so that, hey, I'm going to buy this because my kids will love it because I loved it when I was a kid. There's nostalgia that goes along with it. Well, guess what? Tiger, when Tiger was winning U.S. Opens by a dozen strokes, that was 20 years ago. So now there's a nostalgic element to it, and there's also this guy was great. I get to be part of this. And you want to be able to say, I saw Jordan score 50. I saw the first players that I thought of, McGuire and Bonds. Well, maybe not. I saw so-and-so, you know, Mike Trout, whatever. And you want to say, I saw Tiger shoot a 64 on a Sunday in the PGA. Like, that's it. But that's the kind of thing you'll tell your children about, your grandchildren about. You're not going to tell your kids about watching Brooks Koepka hit a tournament-winning putt. You just won't. You never will. I don't care how good he gets. It just won't be that.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And the other thing about the dynamic between those two is that Koepka said he heard all the roars.
I love it.
and he actually said on one of them he was about to putt, and he heard the roar. He stepped back, and he's like, I got to make this putt. And he went ahead and made the birdie. So Koepka really responded well. But to your point about the moment, when Tiger birdied 18, that was the most exciting moment of the tournament because he shot that 64, made a great putt on the last hole, doing everything he could to put himself into position.
Fist pump.
Huge.
Red shirt.
Huge, like, fist pump.
Ah, Sunday.
But the thing that I started...
That's what it felt like.
The thing that kind of surprised me as I was thinking about it afterwards was just how excited Tiger was, because normally for him to give that reaction on the last hole of the tournament, it's because he knows that he either won the tournament or he's probably going to be in a playoff because he knows the leaderboard. But when he made that putt, he knew that he was still down by two. Koepka only had two holes to play, including the par 5 17th. I don't really think he could have thought that he was going to be in a playoff.
No, it was more of I just hit the, like, it was emotion. And that's one of my favorite things about sports is raw. I talked about things that you love. I love teams. And I love if you're part of a team, it doesn't matter, tall, short, whatever. If you can help the team win, help the team win. And the celebrations that you see that include all types of humans, for me, that's one of my favorite things about sports, because it doesn't matter. If you perform, you can perform. The other things is emotion. And in Tiger's case, just that raw emotion of, I just hit this thing. And I think part of it was, yeah, did he win the tournament? No, but it was like, I'm back. I overcame all these obstacles and now I'm back. It's Sunday. I just shot a 64. Dude, like, regardless of whether you win the tournament, he beat so many other things. He's back.
I wonder if part of what was in the back of his mind was the thought of, hey, I just shot a great round. He'd never shot 64 on a Sunday in a major.
That blows my mind.
It does. Me as well. But he shot the best round of the day. And so I'm wondering if it was just sort of the culmination of the day where he came to the course knowing that, hey, I'm just going to put up the best score I can. I can't control what Brooks Koepka does. The guy's a machine. He's likely to shoot 66 like he did. But I'm just going to go and put up the best number I can. And he didn't hit a fairway on the front nine, but shot 3 under. And then he managed to make that tough left to right 20-foot birdie putt on 18 to shoot 64. And part of it was just, hey, my goal today was to put up the best number I could, and he really felt like he did. The other part I wonder about in the back of his mind was, hey, I just clinched my spot on the Ryder Cup, because he's been, you know, charging up the leaderboard with the Ryder Cup standings. He got all the way up into the top 20 with that finish. And I think he kind of must have felt, hey, I just showed everyone that I am back, like you're talking about. And I'm back. And what that means is not only did I just finish second in this major, but I sewed up my captain's pick to play in the Ryder Cup in September.
Yeah, there was a lot going on there. It was fun to watch it. Even though I wasn't there, you were. So speaking of being there, the next day you got to fulfill something that I think everybody dreams about. You got to play the course in basically Sunday condition, give or take. If you are interested in seeing some of the shots, they are on the Fox on Sports Facebook page. You can actually just go to foxonsports.com, Fox with two X's, and it will redirect you to the Facebook page. But talk a little bit about what you saw out there on Monday on the course that almost it makes you suspend disbelief at what some of these guys are able to do on Sunday.
Yeah, it really does. It was a wonderful opportunity, and I've got to thank Matt Hong of Turner Sports for adding me to the list of folks who got to play on Monday. It was just a tremendous opportunity, and that is exactly the takeaway I had was. It was just unbelievable to think about how these guys can score on this course. And the thing that drove it home was when I got into the rough. I got into the rough on the fifth hole, you know, decent drive, but just about 8 or 10 yards to the right. So I'm in the thick rough, and you expect it to be difficult. But I never expected that it would take me 5 shots to get to get back onto the fairway. I think the first shot I took was like a 7-iron because I thought I could, okay, maybe if I hit this well, I can get it to the green. Well, it went about 5 yards. So then I start using my wedge. And even though I was taking pretty much a full swing, I couldn't get it back onto the fairway. And it happened on the next hole as well. It took me 3 shots to get out of the rough. And one of the pictures up on Fox on Sports is my ball in the rough on 17. By that point, it had been drilled into my head that when you barely can see the ball, you just have to go sideways with the wedge, with your only goal being to get it onto the fairway. But even when that's your goal, you really have to have the right technique and execution to make it work, or otherwise your club just gets caught up in all that grass. The ball goes nowhere. So to see that these guys can get in that rough, like if Tiger missed every fairway on the front nine, but somehow still shot 3 under, is mind-boggling.
So is the proper technique using a wedge and getting under it and taking the grass with you, or is the proper technique a lower iron and hooding it?
Yeah, basically, you know, it's funny because I found this article on golf.com last week that was describing what to do to get out of the rough, and that's one of the things they say is when it's deepest in the grass, what you have to do is you have to put it back in your stance, come down very steeply with your wedge so that you're just trying to make sure you can make contact with the ball to get it back onto the fairway. Mm-hmm. But the thing I laugh about in that article is the pictures that they show of the golf balls. It looks like you're in the fairway. They're trying to depict your ball in a difficult rough. But there's just a little bit of grass.
Yeah. The rough of the PGA from the pictures that are on the Facebook page, those look like that's a hazard.
Yeah, it's like 6 or 7 inches of grass.
That's a hazard.
And it's thick because, you know, there'd been so much rain. And, of course, since this was Monday, they certainly had not cut the rough. So it might have been a tiny bit more challenging than the day before on Sunday, but a whole new level of appreciation for what these guys can do. And then when I see some of the highlights of Tiger hitting out of that rough, you see how hard he swings, and he cranks it up to another notch to power through the grass and get the ball, you know, as close to the green as he can.
Yeah, it's amazing to see how he does it. And then what was it on 16 or 17 when he hit his drive almost out of bounds?
17.
Okay. And then chose to punch it back into the fairway, giving himself a good shot out of there. But again, I mean, you look at something like that and you go, well, that's how I would have played it. Like, I'm not going to try to be a hero from there.
Yeah, no, and that's what I learned by 17. That's what I did. I was able to chip it out, and I was about 260, and it was probably my most exciting shot of the day. I took driver off the deck because at that point I was thinking, well, I've got nothing to lose, and it actually worked out pretty well. I got it up by the fairway and made a bogey. But probably the real highlight was the 11th hole, getting back to that drivable par 4. I made par on that hole.
Yeah,
same as Tiger on Sunday. So I'll always remember that.
Yeah.
But that's one of those turning points for Tiger that I wonder if he looks back on and wonders, because he didn't try and drive the green. He laid up, wedged onto the green, had about that 15-foot putt that just looked like it was dead center, but it stopped right on the lip. So he ended up making par on 11. And then what you're talking about at 17, that par 5, he did not make birdie. So those two shots right there could have been the difference, because he lost by 2.
Right. Well, I it's funny because I talk about sports with just about everybody, and I don't remember what I say on air versus not. But it's, I look at Tiger's opening round 70, and you say, where could he have picked up a stroke here? Where could he have picked up a stroke there to potentially put himself where he needed to be? And it's, to me, it's analogous to you watch a football game. The last minute, it's, please reset the clock from 45 to 47 seconds. But think about during the first quarter, an extra couple seconds runoff, nobody cares. But the 2 seconds matter later, and the one shot matters on Sunday that might not matter as much on Thursday.
That's right. That 70, he started off bogey double. So he was plus 3 in his first two holes. If he goes par there, 3 shots would have made all the difference in the world. But the last thing I want to mention from playing the course was, it was just crazy how different it was visually without 5,000 fans around each hole.
Oh, I'm sure.
I literally saw a water hazard that I didn't even know was there. The par 3 sixth hole that I talked about last week, where I was standing at the tee watching Ricky Fowler and Ian Poulter, you know, I looked down towards the green and I'd never even saw the water hazard. And I'd actually, before that, I'd been up by the green, but we were a little bit, the water hazard was on the other side of the green and down, so you couldn't see it because, again, the fans were in the way. But I'd even been on the right side of the hole looking across. And so, you know, you just, it's like a whole new world out there without all those fans. Same thing on the eighth hole. I was watching Snedeker, who we're going to need to talk about later in the show.
No, you mean Sneds.
Sneds. I was watching Sneds chip onto the eighth green, which is a par 5, and we're about 50 yards away, and the green is a little bit elevated. And that was my big memory of that hole when we were watching it on Friday live. But then playing it on Sunday, I finished the hole, started playing 9, and then looked back at 8 and said to myself, oh, yeah, that's where I saw Snedeker. And the whole course just looks so different when you're actually playing it and you don't have, you know, like I said, thousands and thousands of fans around every shot.
I mean, it's probably a lot like if you were playing a softball game at Fenway with nobody in it versus a full crowd versus playing at Chubbuck Field, where I'd be derelict if I didn't say Hanson hit a grand slam last night only because I had lined out to second base the previous at bat.
That's so, right. You had a laser and
P-Rod right at the second baseman.
Left the bases loaded for me.
Left the bases loaded, and then Hanson cleared him. So, all right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back and talk. This is Golf Talk on on Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Back here on Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1, we're going to break up our Golf Talk segments with a little bit of other stuff. So we were talking about Tiger Woods on Sunday, and I guess I'm going to go back to one thing, and then we're going to go back to the most exciting things. Would you ever use a long putter like Adam Scott uses?
Sure, and you know, I've never even tried it. I'd like to try it.
No, I couldn't. I would rather putt poorly with a regular length putter.
No,
than have the chin resting on my putter.
I've had too many days putting poorly that I would try it and be happy if I could shave a couple strokes off.
You should try putting cross-handed.
I have.
That works well.
I may have to go back to it.
Yeah, it's very good. Anyway, most exciting plays in sports. I have three. You have three. Go.
Number one, the walk-off hit in baseball.
Okay, the walk-off hit in baseball is a good one. I had, did you watch that Cubs-Nationals game the other day? You were still in St. Louis. So Nationals are up 3-0, bottom of the ninth. Hit batsman gets grazed, little infield single. Another guy, Contreras, gets hit by a pitch. Cubs bring in a pinch hitter, David Bodie. Bodie goes down to his last strike and hits what has been called a golden grand slam or an ultimate grand slam, which is to say everybody's fantasy in their backyard from the history of ever. Down three, bases loaded, two outs, bottom of the ninth, 442 feet to center field. See you later. Rookie hits a walk-off ultimate grand slam to win the game.
That's right. That is the perfect example of it. And the reason why it was number one on my list is because in that exact scenario, with that pitch, either team can win the game.
Yes.
You don't know.
Yeah.
If he gets him out, game over, Nationals win. If he hits a grand slam, the Cubs win.
I wish I had known, I hadn't looked, what the win probability for the Nationals was when he was down to his last strike. But yeah, he crushed one against Ryan Madsen. I believe it was only the second time that there has been a grand slam to end a game in Cubs history. The first being 1963 when it happened. And it was only the second time in baseball history that there had been recorded an ultimate grand slam, which is a grand slam to end the game trailing by three. And first time in baseball history, the first, proving that if you watch long enough, you will see everything. That a team had been down to its final strike, trailing by three runs and one.
Yeah, that was tremendous. And I had not really...
On that next pitch, I guess.
Yeah, so the I didn't see much of the coverage, but I did see a tweet from Michael Wilbon, who, of course, is from Chicago, and his gripe was this wasn't even number one on ESPN's top 10.
It was number one the next morning.
Okay, so maybe that had something to do with it. But the funny thing about his tweet was he said, if this had happened Red Sox-Yankees, by the next morning, they already would have made a 30
that.
For 30.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. So that was, we were all sitting at my in-law's house in Kansas City watching it. And yeah, everybody not Cubs. I'm not a huge Cubs fan. But, you know, he hits it and somebody had their finger on the button ready to play. Hey, Chicago, what do you say? Cubs are going to win today. Written by the late, great Steve Goodman. So, all right, that's number one. What's your number two? I do like the walk-off. I was torn. I love the idea of a shootout, but I also find that to be super artificial.
Yes. Yes, I agree. So, one other thing on the walk-off hit is just that you in baseball, you never know what's going to come.
Right,
so,
yes.
The guy is up there, and maybe he hits a grand slam, so all of a sudden it has happened. But
yeah.
Maybe he gets a single. Then the next guy up, again, you're right back in that situation. Maybe he hits it, maybe he doesn't. And that's the beauty of it with baseball.
Yes.
My number two is in basketball when, similarly, you have a shot to win the game and you're trailing. So if you're down by two, you're taking a three-pointer. The ball is in the air. If it goes in, you win. If it misses, you lose. And we're not talking about overtime. We're talking about everybody knows when the ball is in the air that the game is going to end with the result of this shot. That's number two.
Right. So that's, I agree with that. I was trying to work basketball into it, but if I was going to compare a basketball and a football thing that are consistent, it would be a pick six or a steal followed by a dunk. Like, it's the momentum 100% shift. I prefer the pick six in front of the home crowd where you have, hey, it's just I'm looking out to the flat and throw a pass and the guy jumps the route and takes it right back the other way. Like,
maybe it's in overtime, so that ends the game.
Oh, dude, but you couldn't compare with that Minnesota Vikings Stephon Diggs play last year. Still, though, it's the pick six that takes the wind out of somebody's sails or completely amps up a crowd. That would be my number two. My number three, I'll let you go first.
Well, my number three is, I'm not sure if it would have been my number three if we made this list on any other day, but I had to honor Sneds with his 59 yesterday.
Putt for a 59.
So a putt for a 59 is what I've listed as number three because it is so rare. There have only been 10 rounds in PGA tournament history sub 60.
Yeah.
And yesterday, Snedeker accomplished that feat by rolling in a 20-foot birdie putt on his last hole to shoot 59, shot 11 under par on a par 70. Just a tremendous round, which it was kind of exciting because it came out of nowhere. He bogeyed the first hole of the day.
Yeah.
After nine holes, he was only 3 under. But he played the last...
So he was 13 under in his last 17?
It was a par 70. So he was 11 under for the day.
Okay.
So he was, 12 under. And I think he parred 2, 3, and 4. So he was 12 under for his last 14. And he was 5 under for his last 5, which included a shot from the fairway on his 15th hole, which was number 6, that just was a slam dunk. He had an eagle on a par 4 where he hit it from the fairway straight into the cup. So just a really exciting round. And you know what was also really fun about it is that he said he knew what was at stake and he thrived in it. He was walking up the last fairway talking to his competitor about the fact that he had a putt for 59. He wanted to make it and he went out and captured the moment by draining it.
Yeah, it's I that's a tough one because it's really infrequent. The walk-off, we're talking about how infrequent like the David Bodie thing was for the Cubs, but this one, that's super infrequent. One I like that is frequent is a triple. We were at the Silver Knights game a couple weeks ago, and you get this. The ball is hit to the gap, so people are cheering. Then it becomes evident that it's not just a double, and it kind of hits this crescendo. It's stand-up triples are rare. So you have then there's a play at the end of it, and is he safe? Is he out? Okay, he's safe, and he gets up. And there's a really great segment from Philip Roth in The Great American Novel. Have you heard this?
No.
So, all right, he says, well... He's talking to his love interest, and he says he loves the triple more than anything in the world. And he says, smacking it first off the wall, up the alley, down the line. However it goes with that there crack. Then running like blazes, round first and into second. The coach down there crying out to you, keep coming. So you make the turn in second. You know it is right on your tail, so you slide. 270 feet of running behind you, and with all that there momentum, you hit it, whack into the bag. Over he goes, legs, arms, dust. Hell, you might be in a tornado, Angela. Then you hear the ump, safe, and you're in there, only that ain't all. She says, what then? Tell me everything. What then? She says, well, the best part in a way, standing up, dusting off your breeches, and standing up there on that bag. See, Angela, a home run, it's great and all. They're screaming and all, but then you come around these bases, and you disappear down into the dugout, and that's it, but not with a triple. You get it? So it's the idea that you're going around the bases, but you hit the home run. Sometimes there are curtain calls. Sometimes you have the David Bodie where you get to be out there and you're surrounded by your teammates who are tearing off your jersey. But a lot of times you hit the home run and that's it. You go down to the dugout. If it's your first home run, your teammates may have vacated the dugout.
They may or may not ignore you.
I love that.
Yeah, I agree with you, though. The triple is, in terms of a almost a more normal play, in any sport, it is so exciting because it also comes out of nowhere. And then it's just a beautiful thing to see somebody fly around for a triple, you know, slide in and have a close play. It's a really exciting play.
Yeah. So, all right, we're done with exciting plays. Now I want to talk, the next thing that we talked about was, you know, I've had it happen in the past. You know, you're on a roll, things are good. You know, maybe you're having a great day at work and you come outside and you realize somebody slashed your tires because they don't want you to go to that next meeting. You're like, dude, all I'm trying to do is do my job and go to my next meeting. This is BS. I mean, we've all had it happen, but it's a part of life, right? Like, you're going good, and all of a sudden a pitcher throws a pitch at your elbow because instead of trying to beat you, the next logical thing is
try and break you.
I'm not even going to get you out. I'm just going to wear you out in the elbow.
Yeah, I'm just going to try and hurt you because I can't beat you. I can't compete with you.
Yeah.
That was the rough greeting that Ronald Acuna Jr. got this week from
the Battle of the Tildes.
Yeah.
Urania and Acuna.
Right. So this is the 20-year-old Acuna who's been on fire for the Braves.
Oh, dude, he's beast.
He's 8 home runs in 8 games. Okay, he's the youngest to ever accomplish that, including he'd hit a home run in 5 straight games. Let's just go through his week leading up to this incident. Last week when he was playing the Nationals, he hit a home run in the top of the 4th inning. Bottom of the 4th inning, he robs a home run. So that's what kind of creates the buzz around him in August. Well, then this Monday, he had a leadoff home run in a doubleheader. He led off the game with a home run in the first game of the doubleheader. Second game of the doubleheader, and this is against the Marlins, he did the same thing. So he led off both games of a double with both games of the doubleheader with a home run. Then on Tuesday, he hit 2 more home runs against the Marlins. So then what happens on the very first pitch of the game on Wednesday against these Marlins?
Jose Urania hits him in the arm. The bench is clear, as it should be. It's just one of those things that just defies logic. Like, to me, that's just not how the game is played. If you're Keith Hernandez, it is, though.
Apparently.
There's no proving there is no bounds of human stupidity and the desire to say, I played the game and these are the unwritten rules of baseball. If they're so important, maybe we should write them down. But first of all, they're killing you. You've lost 3 games. He's hit 3 home runs. You've got to hit him. I'm sorry. People are not going to like that. You got to hit him or at least knock him down. I mean, seriously, knock him down if you don't hit him. You never throw at anybody's head or neck. You hit him in the back or you hit him in the fanny. All right, first of all, I haven't heard anybody refer to it as the fanny in how many years?
Since Keith Hernandez was playing.
Right, seriously. But like, dude, no. No, that's just a bad take.
Yeah, that's too much.
That's a gross take. Just garbage take.
And you know, the manager for the Marlins, Don Mattingly, who played in that same era, he had it right. You know, he did not come to Urania's defense.
As he shouldn't have.
He didn't come out and attack him, but he did so in a way by just acknowledging that's not how we need to do things. We need to try to get the guy out.
Right. Get the guy out. Or, I mean, if you hit him accidentally, great. But, like, just going after the guy right off, no. It's just silly. And it's not, like, I watch a lot of baseball. I had never heard of Jose Urania and his almost 5 ERA until he hit Acuna. But I had heard of Acuna because you can't miss him and Ozzy Albies. Like, the Braves have this nice young core of players that are really fun to watch and a great manager, by the way, and Brian Snicker, too. So,
yeah, Snicker did something great in that moment. He actually was out on the field next to the mound getting in Urania's face. And I thought that was just tremendous. He physically showed that he has Acuna's back. The Braves teammates did the same. And, you know, Snicker, with his post-game interview, was really talking about how upset he was. And, you know, Acuna's got to love that support from his manager as a young player.
Yeah. And the other players see it, too, and it makes a difference. The an interesting footnote about Brian Snicker, and I don't know that I've heard it mentioned. Did you ever read a book called One Shot at Forever by a Sports Illustrated writer named Chris Ballard?
It sounds familiar.
It's about the 1971 Macon High School baseball team. great book, and it's I have it in the house somewhere. I was looking for it and I can't find it, but they had, it was the early 70s, kind of this space between the 60s and I don't know how to describe it other than it's this is a space between when things were buttoned down and when they were loose. And Snicker's high school coach was a guy named Lynn Sweet, who honestly probably dressed a lot like I dress, and you know, t-shirts, like kind of a casual dude, but somehow put together this baseball team out of next to nothing. And Brian Snicker is the first baseman.
Okay.
But it's a quick read, great baseball book. And didn't surprise me. Snicker has been, he's a longtime baseball guy, never got to the major leagues. I think he topped out in AAA. So he's a guy who really put in the work to get there. And it's great to see him leading a team that's on top of the AL East or the NL East too.
Yeah, another footnote on this whole streak and week with Acuña. On on ESPN, they were describing that game because he got hit by pitch, so he left the game the next inning. He didn't have any more plate appearances. And they claimed that the home run streak was still intact. That he, you know, he'd hit a home run in five straight games.
Because
he got hit by pitch, didn't have any other at-bats, that technically the streak would continue. I'd never heard that before, and that doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
It's the same logic that goes along with if you continue a hitting streak if you don't get an opportunity, if you don't have an official plate appearance. So if you go sack fly, walk, hit by pitch, your streak continues.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me. To me, if you step up to the plate and the streak ends, then the streak ends. I like it for him. I like that he doesn't get hurt in trying to continue that streak because it was out of his control. But that surprised me.
If you're playing 6 degrees of Lauren Fox, Brian Snicker in 1978 played for Dirty Al Gallagher, who was the manager of the Kansas City T-Bones. Yeah. So, all right. But no, for whatever reason, that's the rule that applies to streaks. I don't know. You should legislate that out of the game.
Absolutely.
Yes. Dedicate your life to that. Important. So anyway, Snicker, oddly enough, 4 years in the minor leagues, 236 games, hit .254, and topped out in AAA. But longtime coach, longtime minor league coach, and doing all right.
Yeah, he is. We haven't talked about the length of Urania's suspension.
Six games.
Another stat that came out of it was that the first pitch he threw, again, this is the first pitch of the game against the Braves hitters, drills him. It was going right for his back, happened to hit his elbow. But it was 97 miles an hour, and the stat was that was his fastest first pitch of a game all season.
Really?
So he didn't just try and hit him. I mean, he went and dug deep and gave everything he had to drilling him in the back.
Yeah.
Noteworthy.
Yeah, you got to have priorities.
So the article you found was from a writer who was suggesting he should be suspended for the rest of the regular season.
I think that's a bit overboard.
Yeah.
And I think the pearl clutching about that sort of thing, do I agree that he should be suspended? Do I agree that there's no place for it in the game? Absolutely. However, do I think that would be a bit excessive and set some really bad precedents? Yeah.
Yeah, six games is good because he has to miss his next start. It fouls up their rotation. I would have been fine with anything around 10 games. And maybe if he does it again, then you start looking at 15, 20 games or more. But, you know, this will send a bit of a message because, you know, the umpires, we're not even going to give him a warning. They ejected him. He gets a six-game suspension. This will teach him a lesson.
Yeah, you would hope. So with that said, we're about out of time, and if we're not overtime, which is entirely possible. Wanted to thank everybody here at Bedford 105.1, Bill Jennings, Harry Kozlowski, Chris Gentry, Colin Richardson. Thanks to my co-host, Andrew Hansen. And Harry, the show's ready. We will we'll talk to you next week. Have a great week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.